A museum curator by the name of J.W. McGee details the process of dying of thirst. He gives this detailed assessment based on what happened to a 40-year-old miner who spent approximately 7 days in the Arizona desert. He said, "The saliva becomes thick and foul-tasting. The tongue clings irritatingly to the roof or to the teeth in the roof of the mouth. A lump seems to form in the throat. Severe pain is felt in the head and neck. The face feels full due to the shrinking of the skin. Hearing is affected, and many people begin to hallucinate. Then come the agonies of a mouth that has ceased to generate saliva. The tongue hardens into what McGee describes as a senseless weight swinging on the still soft root, striking foreignly against the teeth. Speech becomes impossible, although the sufferers have been known to moan. Next is the blood sweats phase, involving a progressive mummification of the initially living body. The tongue swells to such proportions that it squeezes past the jaws. The eyelids crack and the eyeballs begin to weep tears of blood. The throat is so swollen that breathing becomes difficult, creating an incongruous yet terrifying sense of drowning." Now that everybody in the room wants to go get a drink, I want us to think today about thirst, but not of a thirst for water, not the thirst of a human being for the liquid that gives us life, but I want us to think of the thirst of a child of God for the God who gives us life. Today, as we continue our sermons from Psalms, we're focusing on our amazing God as seen from Psalm 63. And as we look at Psalm 63, you may remember we've been looking at the situational Psalms. We've been looking at Psalms that fit into different situations in the life of David. Now, most of the Psalms we've been looking at recently tie into his early life. And we talked about that most of the situational Psalms in the book of Psalms are basically found between Psalm 50 and Psalm 63 in this section. Most of those we've been looking at deal with the days after he was anointed king and he's on the run from King Saul. But if you look at the beginning of Psalm 63, it says, "A psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah." Now there are two times in his life when this would apply. The first is when he was on the run from Saul and was not yet king. He had been anointed by Samuel but had not yet become king. The second time in his life, when he is fleeing through the wilderness of Judah, was later when he was betrayed by his son Absalom. And at this time he had been king for many years. And based on the statement in verse 11 that says, "But the king will rejoice in God," I believe he's talking about a time in his life when he was king. And therefore, this psalm is not dealing with the time in the wilderness from when he was running from Saul, but it's dealing with his time in the wilderness when he was fleeing from his own son, who rose up in rebellion to take over the empire. Now, what I want you to think about is that, again, a lot of the Psalms we've looked at were early on. And we've talked about his confidence in God. We've talked about his trust that God would help him through. Now we're many years down the road, and he's come full circle. And I found myself, as I read through this, thinking, are we going to see the same David? Are we going to see the same outlook? After all of these years of serving God and all of these years as king, here he is right back in the wilderness again. Right back where he started. He's on the run again. Not now from a previous king, but a young son who would be king. But what is fascinating and powerful to me is we see the same David and the same trust. What I'd like to focus on is three things today. I'd like to think about thirst, trust, and triumph. Thirst, trust, and triumph. Before we highlight just these things briefly, I think we need to take just a moment and rehearse the story. If you want to go back and do some reading on it for yourselves, you can go back to 2 Samuel chapters 15 through 17. Much of this is connected by biblical writers to David's sin with Bathsheba. That sin started a series of dominoes falling in the life of David. It impacted how he raised his children. It impacted the fact he didn't discipline his children because many of the things they needed to be disciplined for, he was guilty of doing himself in connection with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. And so the seed of sin that he planted many years before is producing a wicked plant. But basically, there has been a rift between David and Absalom. And in the 4 years leading up to the rebellion, Absalom has once again been allowed to have contact with the people. And what he has been doing is he has been secretly building up allegiance. He's been acting like a king, riding around in a horse and a chariot. He's been acting like a judge of the people, a role that would be played by the king and would place himself at the gate of the city. When people came in, he would hear their grievances and say, "If I were king, here's what I would do." Secretly behind the scenes, he's been doing kingly things and been looking kingly in front of the people, been winning people over. Kind of subtly, he's been saying to the people, "I would do it differently and I would do it better than the current administration." And so little by little, he's been winning a following. Until finally one day, he asks special permission for David to make a trip, and he gets 200 men to go with him. They don't know that a rebellion is about to take place. So he takes these 200 soldiers and ends up on this trip leading a rebellion. Well, kind of the 200 men are now kind of trapped because they can argue all day long, but it looks to all onlookers like they're a part of the rebellion. So kind of by trickery, suddenly he's got him a small army. And what happens is he is proceeding to take over the kingdom. And he marches on Jerusalem, and David leaves Jerusalem. He wants to spare the city battle. He wants to spare the city bloodshed. This is his city, literally. He and his mighty men had captured the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites, so it really was his town. And he didn't want it to be struck by the sword. He also, throughout, if you read through chapters 15 through 17 of 2 Samuel, he is open to the will and justice and punishment of God. Throughout it, he talks about the fact that if this is God's will, I submit to it. When he's mocked as he's leaving the city, he tells his soldiers not to strike the mocker because if this is God's will, I need to accept it. Over and over he says, whatever God's will is, let it be done. In a tremendous case of irony, he is going to end up hiding at the city of Mahanaim. This is the city, this is a location where Jacob was visited by the angels. This was a Levite city, the priestly tribe that took care of mediating the people's relationship with God. It's also the location from which Ishbosheth reigned. I don't know if you ever heard the name Ishbosheth, but Ishbosheth was a surviving son of Saul. And after Saul and Jonathan died in battle, and David was put up on the throne, people who were still loyal to Saul viewed Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, as their king. Well, he couldn't reign from Hebron or Jerusalem, and so he reigned from Mahanaim. And if you've got the map there, there's a yellow arrow which points to Jerusalem, and then there should be a yellow star, I hope you can see on the screen, which is by the village of Mahanaim. And you can see that it is kind of northeast on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And so that's where Ishbosheth, the rival of David, reigned. And you had two kings reigning over Judah and Israel at the same time. Now it's ironic that many years later, David is run out of town by his own son, and guess where he goes to hide and find refuge? He goes to the same city that his rival had gone to so many years before. What was it like for David? He had to have had this tremendous sense of deja vu. As he was running from Saul in the wilderness, and he's back in the wilderness, as Ishbosheth had reigned from Mahanaim, and now he finds himself there. But if there was one thing that was deja vu for David, it's that he remembered that the same God who was with him when he fled from Saul is the same God who is still with him as he runs from his own son Absalom. I want you to get a sense of the despair he feels. In 2 Samuel 15:23, "And all the country was weeping with a loud voice. All the people passed over. The king also passed over the brook Kidron. And all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness." In verse 30, "And David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives." I want you to think about where he is. I want you to stop and think about the fact that a few thousand years later, someone else is going to be lying on his face, weeping, and his sweat as tears is going to be falling to the ground in this very same location. David, and it says, "And David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went. And his head was covered, and he walked barefoot. And then all the people who were with him, each covered his head and went up weeping as they went." He's walked out of the city. He's crossed over the little brook that's on the eastern side of the city, the same brook Jesus crossed the night he went to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane and was betrayed. And as he walked up that same hillside on the eastern side of the city, if you turn back around, you can look right back over the whole city. And the first thing you would see if you went in Jesus' day would have been the temple, though that temple had not yet been built in David's day. But it says David wept as he walked up over that mountaintop. It is against that background of that journey through the desert that we have the words of Psalm 63. "O God, You are my God. I will seek You earnestly. My soul thirsts for You. My flesh yearns for You in a dry and weary land where there is no water. Thus I have seen You in the sanctuary to see Your power and Your glory, because Your loving kindness is better than life. My lips will praise You. So I will bless You as long as I live. I will lift up my hands in Your name. My soul is satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth offers praises with joyful lips." In my opinion, this is one of the most beautiful psalms in the entire book of Psalms, of the entire 150. And I want you to see not only his poetry, but I want you to see the poetry against the backdrop of what he's going through. He has been betrayed by his son. He has lost his home. He's lost his kingdom. And he is traveling through the desert to find a place of safety. Literally, his life and the lives of his family and followers are hanging in the balance. And so I want you to hear what he says. "Oh God, You are my God." He still, as he journeys across the wilderness, putting his trust in God, he says, "My flesh yearns for You. My soul thirsts for You. I seek You earnestly." I want you to focus on what he says here about "I seek You earnestly." Your translation, you may have a translation that says, I seek you in the morning, I seek you early, I seek you at dawn. Many of you may have heard the song, Holy, Holy, Holy. Lord God Almighty, early in the morning our song shall rise to Thee. That phrase in that song is drawn from Psalm 63. You see, the word here that is translated earnestly in the New American Standard is a word that can mean earnestness or it can mean early. It comes from a noun that can mean early or dawn. And so it is either describing when he seeks God or it is describing the intensity with which he seeks God. Because he's going to talk about in just a few moments how he reflected upon God in the watches of the night. And so if the emphasis is on earliness, he's saying that as I rise in the morning, my first thought is of you. I yearn for you as the earth is waking. If his emphasis is upon the degree of his yearning, he's saying, earnestly, with all that I am, I yearn for you. And it's interesting that as you move beyond that, he says, my soul thirsts for you, my flesh yearns for you. The word for yearn there at the end of verse 1, it is a word that means to want something to the point of exhaustion. The word literally means to pass out. He says, I long for you so zealously that it saps my energy and I fall to my face. He says, I thirst for you. Now I want you to think about that. Where is he at? What is he describing? He's describing a time when his people are in the wilderness. They are in the desert. Remember that description I gave you at the beginning of the sermon about the man who spent 7 days in the desert in Arizona? Remember, David had to leave in emergency conditions. He didn't have time to pack everything he needed. In fact, were it not for people who helped him along the way, they likely would have died of thirst and hunger. And so here is a man traveling with his people, wondering if he's going to be able to find food and water to take care of all of them. A man whose mouth is dry, whose tongue sticks to the roof of his mouth, who says, I don't thirst for water in a dry land. He says, Lord, I thirst for you. What I miss is not the brook Kidron or the cisterns of Jerusalem. What I miss is your presence. I want you to go back with me in your thoughts to 2 Samuel 15. Because we read just a few moments ago in verse 23 how he crossed over the brook Kidron. But then the text says in verse 24 that Zadok the priest came to him carrying the Ark of the Covenant. The priest was still loyal to David. David was the one who brought the Ark into Jerusalem. David was the one who pitched a tent in Jerusalem for the Ark because he wanted God to be present among his people. I want you to think of all of the misuses of the Ark. All of the battles in which the Ark was instrumental. The presence of the Ark and the presence of God on that Ark was the difference between victory and defeat. I mean, if you're going to get your kingdom back, if there was ever a thing you might want with you, it's the Ark of the Covenant. Because the Ark of the Covenant represented the presence and power of God. So Zadok the priest, as they're leaving the city, says, God's going with you. God's Ark is leaving with you, David. And then I want you to hear what David says. Return the Ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he should say thus, I have no delight in him, behold, here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him. He said, God needs to stay in Jerusalem. If it's God's will, he'll bring me back. We don't need to drag God out into the desert or the presence, the ark. It belongs in Jerusalem. Leave it where it belongs. If God favors me, He'll bring me back. But if not, if this is God's will that this happen to me, then I don't need to be dragging His ark out across the desert. So you leave God's ark in the city. And so against that background, David, who could have taken the ark with him, but because he wanted to submit to the will of God and wanted to make sure that it wasn't God's will that he lose his throne, leaves the ark in the city. And so as he thinks back on the times he could go to that tent, he thinks back on the times when he can enjoy the little presence of God, not just in prayer, but as he is present in that tabernacle. He says, out here in the desert, God, it's Your presence I long for. He says, I hunger for You. I thirst for You. I miss being with You. In verse 3, in fact, I want to look at verse 2. He says, thus I have seen You in the sanctuary. He remembers the God of the tabernacle. He remembers the sanctuary. And there's two things impossible here. One, he's either remembering going to the tabernacle where God's presence was in the past, or he's actually having a vision. Because he uses two words for see here, and one of the two words he uses is the word that the prophets used for having seen a vision from God. So it's possible that he was actually given a vision of the tabernacle and the sanctuary while he's traveling through the wilderness. And he says, I long for that. He says, I want that. I thirst for that. I hunger for that. Because he says, Lord, You are better than life. I value You more than my very existence. Guys, you might move on to look at verses 3 through 5. And as he talks about his value of God more than life, I think of the words that were spoken to God in Job chapter 2. In Job chapter 2, the devil goes to God and say, if You will curse Job's flesh, a man will do anything to save his life. But David says just the opposite. David says, I will give up my life. In Acts chapter 20, when Paul was told that as he journeyed to Jerusalem, he was going to be bound and put in prison, he said, I count my life as nothing, that I might do the ministry God has given me to do. In verse 5 of Psalm 63, David says, my soul is satisfied with You. It's not water that satisfies me. It's not food that satisfies me. But Father, You're the one that satisfies me. In verse 6 says, when I remember You on my bed, I meditate on You in the night watches. For You have been my help, and in the shadow of Your wings I sing for joy. My soul clings to You. Your right hand upholds me. He's gone from his thirst for God to reemphasize his trust in God. And I want you to picture up a man who is having a long, sleepless night. And he says, I remember You in the watches of the night. And they had in that day three watches in the night. And maybe you can think of nights when through heartache and sorrow you couldn't sleep and you literally watched the clock change all through the night. You watched the moving of the hands. He says, Lord, I remembered You. I thought of You through the watches of the night. And in verse 7 he says, here's what I remember. You have been my help. I remember that even though I thirst and I hunger now, even though now I'm sleepless, he says, I remember You've been there for me in the past. You were there for me when I ran from Saul. You will be there for me as I run from my own son. And so he says, I place myself under the shadow of Your wings, like a hen that gathers her chicks under her wings. In fact, in Matthew 23:37, Jesus would use that very analogy of Himself as He looked down on the very city of Jerusalem that David had fled from. He wept over the city and He said, so many times I would have gathered you to Myself as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you have rejected My refuge. David isn't rejecting it. David runs to it. David says, even out here in the wilderness, I place myself under your wings. I cling to you. The word for cling there is the same word that's used in Genesis 2:24, where it talks about Adam and Eve becoming husband and wife. It says, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cling to his wife. It's a word that literally means to be glued. It was the same word used in Ruth chapter 1 and verse 14 when Ruth expressed her loyalty to Naomi. She literally said, I am glued to you. I will be glued to you. I will never leave you. And it was a word used in Deuteronomy chapter 10 to describe how God's people will be glued to Him. In other words, He says, no matter what happens in my life and where I go, Lord, I'll never, ever let go of you. I shall be safely glued under your wings. But those who seek my life, He says in verse 9, just to destroy it, will go into the depths of the earth. They will be delivered over to the power of the sword. They will be a prey to the foxes. But the king will rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by Him will glory, for the mouths of those who speak lies will be stopped. As he thought about what God had done for him and renewed his trust in God, he envisioned the triumph that was coming. He says, those who marshal their forces against me, they will be defeated. Those who seek my life. And then he talks about what's going to happen to them. They will go into the depths of the earth. It is just a metaphor for the grave. The same metaphor is used of Jesus in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 9. He says, they'll be delivered over to the sword. They'll be a prey for foxes. The word for foxes here can be translated either as fox or jackal. Many translations now translate it as jackal. He's basically saying they're going to be food for the scavengers. Everyone who has lied will be brought down. But in contrast to that, he makes an incredible statement. But the king will rejoice in God. Now I want you to remember, where is he when he makes this? What's going on when he makes this statement? The king will rejoice in God, because he's talking about his trust and confidence in God. He's on the run because somebody else took his throne. He's no longer on his throne. He's no longer in his capital. Somebody else is running his kingdom. But what does he say? I'm still king as long as God wills it. And I will trust God and I will praise God. And if it's God's will, He'll put me back on that throne. And nothing can stop it. I want you to think about some questions. I want you to think about, what do we do when we're in our deserts? What do we do when we face things that seem insurmountable and overwhelming? I think the first question we need to ask is, what do we want? What was it that David wanted? David thirsted for God. He was hungry for God. Fulfillment for him came in the presence of God. When a person really wants God, that's all that satisfies them. You don't have to ask them to come and worship with God's people. You don't have to ask them to stay for Bible class. You don't have to encourage them to take advantage of the opportunities on a Sunday night or a Wednesday night Bible class. You don't have to beg them to pray or to read their Bibles or to have family devotionals, because if they thirst for God, they just can't get enough of Him or being with His people as they praise Him. What do we want? What do we really want? Because that's what we'll get. What is of the greatest worth to us? David says, you are better than life. Paul said, Lord, you are better than life. Job, by his actions, in spite of the accusations of the devil, said, Father, you are better than life. What's God worth to us? You see, when a person places God as the highest value in their life, you don't have to ask them to give. You don't have to ask them to make sacrifices. You don't have to ask them to step out on a limb and try new things they've never done before for God. because God matters to them more than life itself. So they don't care what they have to endure. They don't care what they have to sacrifice. They don't care what the nations of this world do to them. Throw them into the gladiator arena. Feed them to the lions. They don't care because God's all that value was of value to them. So take their possessions. Take their lives. They don't care because God is better than life. But as we think about what we want, as we think about what's of worth, I want us to ultimately think about where we put our trust. Do we live under God's wings? David said, no matter where I'm at, I'm protected by You and I will trust You even if that means losing my kingdom or my life. You see, people who live under God's wings, you don't have to worry about them quitting. You don't have to worry about them giving up or throwing in the towel. Because nothing in life can stop them. Because they don't see the worries and struggles and hardships of this world. All they see is the underside of the wings of God. And so they do not have anything to fear because God is between them and that which assails them. Would you take out your psalm books and turn to the hymn of encouragement? Major V. Gilbert tells of the liberation of Palestine. When British and Australian troops were in hot pursuit of the Turks as they fled the region. They chased them out across the desert. And as they journeyed across the desert, the British troops were in such hot pursuit of the Turks that they got away from their supply train. There was a supply train of camels bringing all their water. So literally they outdistanced their water in an attempt to get to the enemy and to secure the safety of the people of Palestine. He said literally as they went out across the desert, he said their eyes became bloodshot. Their lips turned purple and began to crack. He said their tongues began to stick to the roofs of their mouths and began to swell. He said literally we were fighting for our lives. We were fighting not only to win the battle but to be able to get to water. And he says, we finally came to a village. And he says, the first thing we noticed when we came into the village were these beautiful cisterns filled with clear, cool water. But the commander said, there needs to be order in how we get to this water. So he had them line up by company in rows of two around the cistern. And the wounded went first, and those in guard duty went next, and then they went company by company. And he said, it took 4 hours for all of us to get something to drink. Many had already died of thirst in the desert. Others were standing there dying of thirst. And he said, but not a person murmured, not a person complained. We all waited, even though we were 20 feet away from the water. We're going to sing an invitation. When you step into that aisle, you're just a few feet away from the water of life. In John chapter 4, Jesus said to the woman at the well who came to that well because she was thirsty, He said, I offer you a water that if you take it, you will never, ever thirst again. And she says, what is this water that I may have it? If your life really thirsts for something more, God is the answer. And if you'll express your faith in Him and be immersed in baptism into Him for the forgiveness of your sins, then you can have the water of life that flows freely. You can never emotionally and spiritually thirst again because you found what your heart is yearning for. That is yours. It is just a few feet away. It's just waiting for us to step up and accept what God offers. What do we thirst for as we stand and sing?